On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Baltimore Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano is under fire over how he's running the nation's fifth largest public housing authority. No one in city government has headed an agency longer than he has. Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun joins me to assess Graziano's tenure so far, what the future might hold for him and for residents in public housing. Plus, Steve Inskeep will be at MICA tomorrow night to talk about his book on Andrew Jackson and his work on NPR's Morning Edition. Steve joins us live with a preview. Then, Nathan Sterner speaks with George Timko from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources about keeping the deer population in check, and Jaywin Russick reviews the new show at Baltimore's Theater Project. That's all coming up on this Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. We'll start with the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, and congratulations to everybody who ran over the Bay Bridge yesterday. Nathan and I did that very same thing last year, didn't we? Had a good time. We missed it this year, indeed, but we congratulate everybody who made it across the bridge yesterday. This morning, we're going to talk about housing. In the last few weeks, there has been much discussion about Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano and the troubled state of Baltimore's public housing. Some residents of public housing have been living in this troubled state for years. Mr. Graziano enjoys the support of Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and some public housing residents who gave him a somewhat limited endorsement last week. But several mayoral candidates have called for Graziano to resign. There have been allegations of sexual abuse on the part of maintenance workers in the Gilmore homes and other locations. Two union representatives in the department were disciplined after they filed an affidavit in the lawsuit surrounding those allegations. They were later reinstated. Senior citizens went without heat or water for several days last month at the Lakeview Towers in Reservoir Hill. And questions arose last week about the elimination of the Inspector General's office at the Housing Authority. Over the years, there have been lawsuits on issues ranging from lead paint to segregation. And soon after Mr. Graziano was appointed to his position by then-Mayor Martin O'Malley, he was arrested at a Fells Point bar for a drunken anti-gay tirade. He entered rehab, and he's stayed on to head the housing agency for the last 15 years. We have asked Mr. Graziano several times to be on our show, and he has, through a spokesman, declined those invitations. But today, we want to talk about Paul Graziano's leadership of the city's largest agency, as well as some of the bigger picture political, racial, and economic dynamics of public housing. Luke Broadwater joins me on the phone from his home in Baltimore. He wrote an excellent profile of Mr. Graziano in yesterday's Baltimore Sun. And Ed Goetz is on the line from Paris. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota and the author of a book called New Deal Ruins, Race, Economic Justice, and Public Housing Policy. Welcome to you both. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Luke Broadwater, let me start with you. Mr. Graziano has two really big jobs. He leads the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. And as I understand it, that's funded by HUD, a federal agency. And he's also the director of the city's Department of Housing and Community Development. Tell us what the distinction is between those two and what the totality of those two areas of responsibility mean for him.
Right. Well, one's a city job and one's a federal job. At the end of the day, though, both are in some way accountable to the mayor of Baltimore. She appoints him to his city job, and they understand, and she then appoints the board, which hires him to the federal job. So while he does have a board that technically oversees him on the federal side, they are in some way accountable to the mayor as well. The federal side is largely dealing with the public housing. We have about 20,000 residents in public housing. It's the fifth largest public housing agency in the United States, despite being we're about the 22nd largest city. And there are lots of different complexes that he has to manage. On the other side, on the city side, he's largely doing things like code enforcement. The vacancy values program falls under him. It's more community housing programs in the community, such as, you know, rehabbing vacants and tearing down vacants and things like that.
You spoke with him on Friday in your piece in yesterday's Sun. You characterized him as feeling misunderstood. In what ways does he think people are misunderstanding what he's been doing as housing commissioner?
Sure, yeah. Well, so over the last several weeks, if not months, he's been under intense fire. And much of it justified, right? There's housing complexes going without heat and water. You had the worst one was Lakeview Towers, obviously, which you mentioned in the intro. But there was also the Monument East apartments in East Baltimore, which was without water for a lower period of time, shorter period of time. There was the housing, the Stexford repair scandal in the Gilmore Homes that's now spread to other complexes as well. So it's been a litany of things, all of which, you know, we've been reporting on blow by blow in the paper. I'm sure you guys have been reporting on as well on the radio. And he feels like in this flurry of negativity around his management that many of the good things he's doing are being overlooked. He feels like he's done a lot of good work on vacancy to values. He feels like when he took over the agency, they had no computer system. They had very negative federal reviews at the time. And so he, you know, he's done a lot to improve the agency, he says, and people are blaming him for problems that are really national funding problems. He points to the fact that they only get about $15 million now from the federal government each year for repairs. They used to get $45 or $42 million a year. And so how can they possibly keep up with the amount of work that needs to be done when the feds have largely cut, and Congress has largely cut almost all the funding that's available for public housing? He says it's a really federal funding thing and it's not him making all these decisions and being a bumbler, so to speak. It's the state of public housing in general.
Sure. And Ed Getz, you've written about this for many years, and you write about a discourse of disaster around public housing. In other words, the way we're talking about it, the way we're assuming things are going is very negative, and that in turn has sort of led to perhaps reduced expectations and, self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. Do you think that's perhaps part of what's going on here in Baltimore?
Well, I think this discourse of disaster that I write about is largely driven by these very high-profile failures of public housing in some major cities. Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and perhaps Baltimore can be included in that as well. What is interesting, I think, about this, though, is that this kind of situation doesn't apply to all public housing. We tend to think of public housing generally as a failure because of these high-profile problems. But in most places where it exists, and at most times, public housing has worked fairly well.
That's Ed Getz. He joins us on the line from Paris. He is the author of the book New Deal Ruins, Race, Economic Justice, and Public Housing Policy. Luke Broadwater also joins us on the phone. And we're sorry to say that Luke's three-year-old daughter is having a bout of strep throat. We hope she is feeling a little bit better soon. So, Luke,
you can hear in the background, I think.
We can indeed, and we're pulling for her. Tell her we hope she feels better. Some people, including former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, for example, find it hard to believe that Mr. Graziano, or at least somebody on his senior staff, knew nothing about these allegations of sexual harassment at the Gilmore Homes and now at other locations. I think at last count, there are 11 women who have stepped forward to join in this lawsuit. When Stephanie Rawlings-Blake was elected mayor, her transition team pointed to a vision deficit on the part of Mr. Graziano. There seems to be this, sort of incredulity about what he knows and about his leadership ability, and this has been going on for a long time. However, he's still there. I mean, he's been there for 15 years. He certainly is, if nothing else, a survivor, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons why he's stayed on the job for so long. One, and I mentioned this in the article, he's politically astute. He didn't like this when I mentioned this to him, but he has given $20,000 over the years to the various campaigns of the mayoral of his bosses. So And he's also hired some of their close allies and friends. I mean, he famously hired Sheila Dixon's boyfriend for a high-ranking post after she told him to do so. And that's been a dispute between them back and forth. His chief of staff is now the mayor, one of the mayor's lifelong friends. That's not to say she's unqualified for the job. She's a lawyer in her own right, but he does know how to put himself in with the right people. That said, I think that the mayors in general have at least thought he did a good job with the situation he had on hand. And I think that your other guest brings up a good point, that the public housing doesn't have to be this way. It wasn't this way for many years in Baltimore, even. It was a respectable place to live. I talked with Kurt Schmoke, who grew up in the Latrobe Homes, and when he grew up in them, there wasn't mold all over the walls. It was a respectable way to live your life, and now he's ashamed to go into the Latrobe Homes. So it's it isn't this way everywhere in the country. It doesn't necessarily have to be this way.
Sure, and Ed Getz, you're right that in the current policy environment, public housing is no longer seen as even a resource worth preserving. I mean, have we given up nationally on public housing? For example, Luke reported that in 2010, a federal study found a $26 billion backlog in capital repairs needed for buildings in public housing. You know, have we just thrown in the towel?
Well, I think largely we have at the federal level. I think that there are some housing authorities around the country that are hanging on and seem to make a go of it. It's difficult at best, but the fact of the matter is that that Congress is underfunding the program, and although I don't have any firsthand knowledge of the Baltimore situation, what was described earlier about the reduction in maintenance funds is consistent with what you hear across the country, that local housing authorities simply do not get the funds from Congress that they need to run this housing. And so many of them are moving to privatize this housing, and in doing so, they tear down the housing, they rebuild it in different ways, but also with private ownership models. So I think in a very fundamental way, we are at a crossroads where we're giving up on this program.
Well, gentlemen, I appreciate your time. We will continue to cover this as we have over the last several weeks here on Maryland Morning, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun. Ed Getz is the author of New Deal Ruins, Race, Economic Justice, and Public Housing Policy. We've got more information on our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Ahead on the program, Steve Inskeep joins us to talk about his latest book in advance of his talk here in Baltimore tomorrow night. First, here is Mr. Sterner.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Tomorrow night at the Maryland Institute College of Art, fans of Morning Edition will get a chance to hear from the host of that very popular program, Steve Inskeep. He'll be at the Brown Center here in Baltimore in an event hosted by my good friend Nathan Sterner. He'll talk about his work on America's most listened-to radio show and his latest book. It is a terrific read. It's called Jacksonland, President Andrew Jackson, Cherokee Chief John Ross, and the Great American Land Grab. It chronicles the rivalry of two strong-willed men in the years after the War of 1812. This morning, Steve Inskeep joins me from the NPR studios in Washington. Morning, Steve. How you doing?
Delighted to be here. Good morning.
Thanks for your time. This is your second book, if I'm counting right. Your first was about the city of Karachi, Pakistan. You talked about the history of that city as well as its recent history. But in this one, you decided to dig further back to the 1830s and Andrew Jackson. What led you to that subject?
Well, it's funny. Those two books are so different, one about a city on the other side of the world and the other about American history, but they both came down in a way to the control of real estate. One was about this rapidly growing megacity, one of those great megacities of the world. Karachi has around 20 million people in it, and it was only a few hundred thousand a few generations ago. And the control of land has been central to that story. When I dug into this episode of American history, it's the early 1800s, it's the expulsion of Indians migrants from the eastern United States, forcing them west across the Mississippi. You find real estate at the heart of that as well. And I did focus on these two characters, Andrew Jackson and John Ross, fighting over land in an emerging democracy, which is what the United States was at the time. And that's really what attracted me to this battle over real estate, is that it was taking place in our system, this recognizable democratic system, which was just taking shape.
Tell us where this real estate is. What is Jackson land?
Okay, Jackson land is my word for land that Andrew Jackson, as a general and then as president of the United States, obtained from Indians for the United States through conquests, through treaties, through legislation as a general, as president, and it is part or all of about seven states. It's an unbelievable expanse. It's the entire state of Florida. It's all of North Georgia. It's a good part of Alabama, Tennessee, North Carolina, Mississippi, West Tennessee. We could go on for quite some time here, a bit of Kentucky even. And it is essentially what we came to think of as the Deep South. Andrew Jackson, in the early 1800s, was creating the Deep South, filling out the South that went on to fight the Civil War and that remains a vital part of our politics and our culture today.
Talk a little bit about the personality of these two very interesting guys, John Ross and Andrew Jackson. Starting with Jackson, one of the stories you relate is that he was in a duel in 1813 that left a lead ball in his shoulder.
Yes.
He was quite a tough character. He was a slave owner. He's a slave dealer. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff about him that it's quite fascinating.
And the 1813 gunfight that you mentioned was actually the second one that left a lead ball in him for years and years afterward. By the time this guy was inaugurated as president in 1829, he had two bullets in him, which suggests the violence of his life and how tough he was. And neither of those bullets was actually from battle. It was from, you know, civic engagement, so to speak. And he was a guy who had a profound sense of his own honor, who was very combative, who did live in this era when duels were really common. But it was also common that the duel would be resolved at the last moment, that guys would decide to resolve their differences through a duel, but there would be some kind of negotiation, some kind of agreement, and they would both fire in the air, or both fire off to the side, or both not fire at all. Something would be worked out. Jackson, on more than one occasion, resolved to go through with a duel. In 1806, in addition to being shot, he actually killed a man in a duel. The 1813 gunfight that you mentioned was a fight against a guy who had been his own military aide and close friend, who went on to be his friend and aide once again later on in life, Thomas Hart Benton. But he was willing to go after this man with weaponry. And you get a sense of the violence of what was then the American frontier and the violence of his personality. But he was also a guy who had a keen strategic sense, who seemed to know where he wanted to go in life and kept this driving ambition pushing him forward.
And you talk about how he combined his sense of national security with an urge for personal gain and land development. And his chief rival in this, Cherokee chief John Ross, you write that he was a century ahead of his time. This is also a formidable character, too.
You know, this is an undiscovered story to me, really. I knew a little bit about Andrew Jackson before I got started in this research. I mean, you see him right there on the $20 bill. You hear about Andrew Jackson. You hear that song, that terrible song from the 1950s about the Battle of New Orleans. You learn something. John Ross was an unknown character to me. He was a son and grandson of Scottish traders and Cherokee women. He was accepted as Cherokee by the Cherokees of the southern, what became the southern United States. And he became the leader, the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in a time when they were fighting to preserve their land and their rights within this rapidly expanding United States in the early 1800s. And instead of doing that by going to war, as many Indian tribes and nations did, John Ross decided to fight within the American system, which he accepted. And so he was arguing for the rights, in effect, of a racial minority within the wider United States. and setting patterns that would later be followed, perhaps unknowingly, but followed by civil rights leaders more than a century later on some of the same ground in the South. And John Ross did things that civil rights leaders later did, like gaining white allies, primarily through religious connections and religious communities, battling in Congress, battling in the media, getting the word out by starting their own newspaper. When everything else failed, going to the court, suing in the Supreme Court, and actually winning a case, although it was effectively disregarded. The Cherokees won a famous case in 1832. And when all else failed, when even the courts failed because the ruling did not have the effect that it should have had, the Cherokees tried a form of civil disobedience. Soldiers came to take them off of their land, and they didn't go anywhere. They refused to go anywhere. It's a really dramatic story. We learn a phrase of it. We learn something about the Trail of Tears, which is what it's called when the Cherokees were finally forced to move west to what is now Oklahoma. But I think we miss so much because the Cherokees were more than mere victims in this story. They were actors in this story who fought in their own defense. And even if they lost, it's a very dramatic record. They held out for a very long time.
Talk to somebody who read your book who is actually a descendant of John Ridge, one of the Cherokee figures you write about in the book. Her perspective is that of a Cherokee, and she said that this notion of Indian removal, removing them from the Southeast and displacing them to the West, is equivalent to genocide. Would you concur with that assessment?
I would argue a little bit with that term. I don't have a problem with people using it about different parts of the experience of European colonizers and counting the native peoples of North and South America. Just think of all the countless people who are estimated to have died from disease, from wars, from slavery, from other issues over the years. But the specific policy that came to be known by the awful phrase Indian removal seems to me better described by other words. The intent was not to exterminate a people, to destroy a people. It was, in effect, to segregate them, which is a bad enough term, an awful enough term to use. The idea here was that Indians were inferior, incapable of being properly civilized according to the white people of the time, even though Cherokees and others actually were taking on white customs and white clothes and education and modern agriculture and so forth. They were civilizing by the standards of the time. It was presumed that they couldn't do it and that they should be shoved off to the side, off into the distance where they could live their separate and segregated lives. It is a monumental atrocity. I'm not sure that genocide is exactly the word for it, though.
And speaking of civilized, when we look at the current political discourse, a discourse that Andrew Jackson still has some sort of influence and presence in, the annual Jefferson-Jackson dinner in Iowa,
yeah,
which took place a couple of weeks ago. The insiders refer to it as the Jeff Jack. There are some people sort of walking away from that association with Andrew Jackson, or Thomas Jefferson for that matter, principally because of the fact that they owned slaves. Do you think Jackson's influence is destined to wane even further as the years progress?
Well, it's been a huge news year for Jackson, hasn't it? There's been a campaign to put a woman on the 20 in place of Andrew Jackson. The Treasury Department hasn't quite done that. They're changing the $10 bill with Alexander Hamilton instead, at least for now. There has been this controversy over the Jefferson-Jackson dinners, and I think that it all reminds us how central Andrew Jackson's story and different parts of that story is to the American story, for better or for worse. This was an age when the United States was becoming more small-d democratic. It's been a republic from its founding. It was not all that democratic at the beginning. There was a small group of elites who were making a lot of the decisions. There weren't all that many people who voted, and the Constitution was set up to curb the power of majority rule. Andrew Jackson arrived and was a great proponent of the idea of majority rule. Now, he had a very specific idea of majority rule, that it should be the majority that supported him, and whatever he wanted was what he believed the majority wanted. It was a self-serving idea of majority rule. But he talked a lot about democracy, at least for white men. And it was a time when the media were exploding in number. The number of newspapers was increasing across the country. Political participation was going up. Percentage of people who voted was going up. Mass political events and rallies were going up. It became, before long, this era of great long speeches like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which went on for hours. It was a democratizing period that Andrew Jackson, with all of his monumental flaws, became a symbol of. And those Jefferson-Jackson dinners just emphasize how that has lasted to this day. Now, it is a fair question. Do you still want to honor a man who was a slave owner and who was the greatest single architect of Indian removal and who did many other things that we would consider awful by our standards? But you kind of can't get away from his legacy. The best thing to know about Jackson, I think, is that his critics today are using the democratic process, using the media, using their right to speak out, using arguments, using creative political techniques. They are using techniques that Andrew Jackson's political party pioneered generations ago to criticize and get a fuller picture of the proper reputation of Andrew Jackson.
On 81, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Steve Inskeep, the host of Morning Edition. Steve, you have more listeners in the morning than anybody else, and the media in particular has been under a good bit of scrutiny in these last few weeks. Just this morning, you all were reporting about the Carson campaign. Dr. Ben Carson from Baltimore, of course, saying, yeah, you know, complaining that he's being scrutinized in a way that other people aren't. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I don't think that he's being scrutinized in a way that other people aren't. That doesn't mean that all the scrutiny has been fair or unfair, but the fact is that when a candidate goes up in the polls, he or she will get additional scrutiny. This is inevitable. There is something a little bit extreme, a little bit unbalanced about it. People pay no attention to a presidential candidate when he's at 5%, and then it gets up to 15% or 20%, and suddenly every little bit of his or her life will be thrown out there for scrutiny. So it's excessive, and we're excessive sometimes in ignoring people, and then excessive in paying attention to little things about them. But with those excesses acknowledged, I think you would rather have a careful look at the people who want to be president than to not have a careful look at the people who want to be president. And in the case of someone like Ben Carson, there is a record there, and there are statements that he's made, and there's a book that he's written, and there are things that you can explore.
Indeed.
And so simply asking questions about that seems to me to be perfectly fair and perfectly democratic, although it is fair of him to argue that someone has not told the truth about him. So make your case. Get the truth out there if you can.
Steve Inskeep, you can hear him every morning on Morning Edition here on 88.1. You can see him tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Brown Center at the Maryland Institute College of Art. Steve will talk about his book, Jacksonland. He'll sign copies, and he'll be in conversation with our very own Nathan Sterner. We've got all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Steve Inskeep, thanks so much. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
Speaking of Nathan Sterner, coming up after a break for news, he will be enlightening us as to the status of the deer population in Maryland. Nathan, we are looking forward to that. First, we have our weekly theater review from Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Stick around. The Baltimore Theater Project was founded in 1971 with a focus on the work of emerging artists. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been there this week to see the premiere of a brand new show called Cabaret Noir. Here's her review.
Cabaret Noir summons up a world where Philip Marlowe or Mike Hammer, or for that matter, Guy Noir, would feel right at home. Stage versions of film noir aren't new. Sunset Boulevard and City of Angels were big, glitzy Broadway musicals that won Tony Awards. Washington-based Happenstance Theater takes a much more low-key approach. Cabaret Noir is an ensemble-created work based in stylized movement, humor, mime, dance, and a dash of puppetry. The show is making its world premiere at the Theater Project. Stylized is the key word. Film noir has a definite look and feel. Happenstance achieves that with minimal scenery, just props really, along with stunning period costumes by the company's founder, Sabrina Mandel. There's also an almost non-stop musical score, composed, or borrowed and arranged, and performed by the gifted Karen Hansen, songs by everyone from Tommy Dorsey to Randy Newman. Cabaret Noir looks good and sounds good, but it's missing something crucial to the genre, a plot. There are hints of plot, some sort of scandal involving the owner of a seafood cannery and a murder and the mayor. There's also a recurring thread about a man trying to commit suicide by jumping off a ledge. He gets interrogated by the police, though it's not completely clear why. In fairness, I should point out that Cabaret Noir is subtitled A Film Noir-Inspired Theatrical Montage. The show is a series of vignettes, some of which connect to others. But the connections, recurring characters and snippets of plot, never fully connect or lead to a resolution. If there's a through line, it's hard to follow. Part of this is due to the fact that words are not a major element in Happenstance's productions. That's a difficulty when it comes to the dialogue-heavy, intricately plotted genre of film noir. At this point in its development, Cabaret Noir is caught somewhere between a bill of noir-flavored acts and a tale of mystery and intrigue. The Candor and Ebb musical Chicago pulls off both, but its songs progress the plot and develop characters. Cabaret Noir's characters are just types, the hard-boiled detective, the femme fatale, the wrongly accused man. Not that there aren't some wonderful bits along the way, lots of them. One of the best involves a man and woman, played by Sarah Olmsted Thomas and Alex Vernon, who slip off a high window ledge. They cling to each other to climb back up, a feat depicted while lying prone on the floor. At another point, Vernon is on the ledge with a different woman, Gwen Grassdorf. She isn't so lucky. No sooner does she admit, "I think I'm falling for you," than that's what happens. Another slick effect, which winds up with her singing Marlene Dietrich's trademark, Falling in Love Again. There are also some beautifully staged slow-motion fight scenes, more like brawls, with the performers toppling like dominoes. One of the cleverest effects is the way Happenstance depicts wind. Actors manipulate long rods attached to newspaper pages that crinkle and careen along the floor. Or performers dash across the stage, whisking away other actors' loosely held fedoras or eyeglasses or shoes. Two seasons ago, Happenstance brought a circus-oriented piece to the theater project. A circus is a series of acts, so that worked well structurally. Cabaret Noir wants to be a series of acts and weave in a story. Right now, like that windswept newspaper, parts of it are still drifting.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Cabaret Noir is at the Baltimore Theater Project until Sunday. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. After a break, Nathan will bring us up to date on deer. They're doing a lot more than just dating these days. Nathan will explain after the news here on Maryland Morning.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Love is in the air, at least if you're a deer. It's deer breeding season, that time of year that deer-related accidents on the state's roads skyrocket. For a look at Maryland's deer population, we're joined by phone by George Timko, Assistant Deer Project Leader with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Nathan.
I live near Baltimore's Herring Run Park, and based on my own entirely unscientific observations, it appears there are a lot more deer this year than there have been in past years. Are you hearing this from other deer watchers?
Well, we're hearing it from quite a few residents around Maryland, including Baltimore City, and it's obviously anecdotal, but it's pretty easy to assume that deer numbers are increasing in those areas where they're not being controlled.
And deer are not being controlled in Baltimore City because there's no hunting here.
There's no hunting, and there's very little other options to manage deer in developed areas like the city.
What sort of options are there other than hunting?
Well, outside of regular hunting, managed hunts where they're highly regimented by park officials or military bases, or in the case of urban and suburban settings, sharpshooting, which has its own controversial subject, and then, of course, capturing and euthanizing deer, and then, of course, the non-lethal measures such as fertility control, deer resistant plants, repellents, fencing, netting, that sort of thing.
Is that sort of stuff being done in Baltimore?
By individuals, to some degree, some of that is occurring. And largely in most of the municipal areas, including Baltimore, very little to nothing is being done.
What sorts of complaints do you get about deer?
Well, the number one complaint is usually deer eating my flowers, my landscaping. I can't grow anything on my property because of the deer eating stuff up. The other issues, of course, are, you know, deer are walking out in front of my cars and they're banging up my vehicles. To the real extreme situations where people are really complaining about deer, of all things, pooping in their yard.
Deer also carry deer ticks, which spread Lyme disease. Have we seen any increase in the spread of that disease in Maryland?
Well, anecdotally, yes. I mean, local health departments keep track of that information, but it's really more of a concern from the public about seeing deer, and then, of course, the thought of Lyme disease and the potential for that. Really, the disease is caused by a spirochete bacteria that lives inside the ticks, and they're actually not per se deer ticks, but black-legged ticks. They just get the rap deer tick because they're often found on deer, and deer do transport them.
In western Maryland, there's also been an uptick in something called chronic wasting disease. It's fatal to deer, not to humans. Tell us about that.
Yes, CWD has been found in a handful of deer out in western Maryland. We annually monitor for deer diseases, including chronic wasting disease. And specifically in western Maryland, because of outbreaks in surrounding states, we started focusing our efforts in that general vicinity in Washington, Allegheny counties, and in that area. Since, I guess, 1999, we started collecting data on sick deer, but in the 2000s, we started actually actively going out and collecting samples from hunters and roadkills and any sick deer in that specific vicinity of Allegheny County. We found 6 positives to date. We've sampled over 8,000, nearly 9,000 samples to date.
And I assume you're going to continue to sample this year.
We are, and it's kind of like looking for a needle in a haystack, and we're kind of looking in the right haystack, so we're specifically concentrating on that area of Allegheny County where it's been found, and then surrounding areas in eastern, or what I should say, western Washington County.
One of the ways Maryland manages deer, of course, is, as we mentioned, through hunting. Deer archery season's been underway since early September. Firearm deer hunting season starts later this month. Last year in all, Maryland hunters harvested more than 86,000 deer. Do we know how many deer there are in Maryland at this point?
We annually get an estimate of abundance based on different parameters, the birth rates of deer, what we find at the meatpacking houses, and a number of deer that are found on roadways. And we kind of have an estimate of abundance based on those numbers. Roughly in the state, there's about 200,000 deer estimated as of our most recent estimate. And that's declined, to be honest, over the past decade from roughly 300,000 deer. And the public often question those numbers. They say, well, how is that possible when I'm seeing more deer in my backyard? The reality is, if you're looking at the state as a whole, there's lots of areas of the state where hunting is being used to control deer, but there's a lot more areas of the state, an increasing area of the state that's not being managed through hunting or any other lethal means, and that's where the deer numbers are probably increasing.
The developed areas, like Baltimore City.
Exactly, those developed areas. And quite frankly, if you look at a land cover map of the state, 40 years ago, you know, our development was really left and relegated to Baltimore and Washington and that corridor and there. But here, 40 years later, the, quote, development, the red on the map, which indicates development, is basically taking up all the center and southern portion of the state. So the increased development tremendously has curtailed what activities, including lethal measures, can be done in a lot of these areas.
So we can expect to see more and more deer in developed areas this year and the year to come?
That's probably a good bet. Until, you know, the local municipalities and local governments and the public get more involved in actively managing deer, it's easy to assume that deer populations will increase.
When we talk about deer in Maryland, we usually are referring to white-tailed deer. But over on the Eastern Shore, there's another kind, sika deer, originally from Japan? How's that pronounced?
Well, we do have sika deer. They were imported back in the early 1900s to an island in the bay, and quite frankly, they've kind of left that island and moved on to the mainland in Dorchester County, and now their population seems to be spreading. They're actually an exotic elk. They're an Asian elk that is pretty small in size, almost a chocolate brown color with white spots on it. Since they're related to elk, they have the antlers that aren't similar to whitetails. They kind of branch out straight back like an elk does, and they do have elk-like behavior, and they're bugling and their reproductive behavior. So they're definitely a different animal.
You said their population is increasing?
We're assuming it's increasing. Again, same thing. We've got roughly 5,000 deer and an estimate of abundance on the population on the shore. But, you know, every year it seems like hunters are seeing these deer outside of those traditional areas of Dorchester County, and they're expanding their range.
George Timko is Assistant Deer Project Leader with the Maryland DNR. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
There's more about deer in our state at WYPR.org/Maryland Morning, including information about Maryland's hunting seasons and about non-lethal methods of controlling the deer population. For Maryland Morning, I'm Nathan Sterner.
And I'm Tom Hall. Before we go, I want to call your attention to our website, again, WYPR.org/Maryland Morning, where you will find a picture of the Maryland Morning staff, our producers, myself, Nathan Sterner, and Guy Fawkes, who is in wax effigy. He was burned this weekend in memory of Guy Fawkes Day, which happened last November. And this is a yearly project of our own Nathan Sterner. So, Nathan, this is something that you have been interested in and have done every year for as long as I've known you.
Yeah, I started celebrating Guy Fawkes Day, which, if you don't know, is a holiday that's started back in 1605, 1606 in England after a failed plot to blow up British Parliament and kill King James I. First, in the wake of the failed gunpowder plot, Guy Fawkes, who was part of the plot, the first one to be caught, was burned in effigy every year. I got involved in celebrating Guy Fawkes Day as a lark, really as a bad joke back when I was in college, but it was something that I kept with since the first time I did it was 1997, and I sort of built a weird wax effigy of Guy Fawkes, which is not the traditional way to celebrate this holiday, but it's the way I kind of enjoy doing it.
Yeah, so you ask us all to donate used candles.
Yes.
Which we all try to do. And then you take these candles and you melt them down, and you go through great trouble creating this effigy of Guy Fawkes. I mean, Mr. Fawkes looks terrific in this
He looks like a guy. You know, the word guy in the English language, when you say, look at that guy over there, it actually comes from a Guy Fawkes. Because people, over the centuries, make this effigy and they burn it. And at one point, a strange-looking person came to be called a guy because the effigy would look so strange. And then the word guy just meant a person. And now when we say, yeah, such a wise guy, it's really hearkening back to Guy Fawkes.
It just became this guy.
Yeah.
And you burn him in effigy. You did this up at your parents' place in Pennsylvania over
this
the weekend.
True, yep.
Yeah. And we've got pictures of all of this on the website. Well, because the creation itself is terrific. He looks great. He's got a tie. He's got, you know, a red shirt, green
right
pants.
Right now, he's just a little pile of ash, though.
He's terrific. So, yes. Yeah,
until next year.
Until next year. All right. So check it out on the website, WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. On Wednesday, we're going to have a conversation about the Republican debate, which is happening tomorrow night. That'll be with E.R. Shipp from Morgan State University and Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, along with Richard Cross, who's a Republican strategist and blogger. I hope you can join us for Maryland Morning. For Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.